All right, I'd like to call to order this hearing of the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Today is March 28th, and we will, first of all, I would like to just remind everyone, if you're not speaking in this part of the hearing, to please keep your video off. And we have a lot of people on the call today, and that will be helpful. So first, we'll start by calling the roll. Ms. Biedernhofer.
Liebling.
Present.
Hewitt. Hewitt. Schumacher.
Schumacher present.
Ackland.
Ackland present.
Backer.
Backer present.
Bonner.
Bonner present.
Bierman.
Bierman present.
Bolden.
Bolden present.
Damoth.
Damoth present.
Freiberg.
Present.
Grunhagen.
Present.
Keel.
Present.
Morrison.
Morrison present.
Munson.
Present.
Pryor.
Pryor present.
Quam.
Present.
Ryer.
Ryer present.
Schultz.
Present.
Wolgamut.
Wolgamut present.
A quorum is present.
All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Niedernhofer. Quorum being present. So we have two sets of minutes that need to be approved today. We have March 22nd and March 23rd. So I'd like to take those one by one, if we could. Representative Damoth, would you be able to move the minutes of March 22nd?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. So members, these sets of minutes were sent out with your packets. Is there any discussion? Representative Damoth has moved approval of the minutes of March 22nd. Is there any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, all in favor of approval, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes from March 22nd are approved. And let's see, Representative Bonner, would you be able to move the minutes of March 23rd?
I would be delighted to move the minutes from March 23rd of 2022.
Thank you very much. So the minutes have been moved for approval. Is there any discussion to the minutes of March 23rd? Seeing none, all in favor of approval, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes of March 23rd are approved. Thank you, members. All right, today we are continuing to hear and take testimony on the governor's budget recommendations in our area of the budget. And when we heard this last week, we started hearing about the budget. The Commissioner Malcolm was not able to be with us, but she is here with us today. So we are delighted to have her with us. And then there is an A1 amendment, which is the revised supplemental budget, because as you all know, after the budget forecast comes out, the governor puts out a revised budget. And that's what we have in the amendment. And I just need to ask, before the commissioner speaks, I need to ask Mr. Aquilin, do we not need to adopt that?
Madam Chair, we do not, since we're hearing this on an informational basis.
Okay. All right. Very good. So but just so members know, and that's in your packets, that is what we're talking about today. So with that, we welcome Commissioner Malcolm, and please go ahead and talk about your new budget.
Well, thank you so much, Madam Chair and members. Good afternoon. I'm going to be extremely brief. I know Deputy Commissioner Kelly went over the budget and the revisions to the budget with you last Friday. I just wanted to take a moment to thank you again for your extraordinary support of not only the Minnesota Department of Health, but your local health departments as well over this just incredible, hard to find the words really, last couple of years and what it has meant, certainly for everyone in our state, and for our entire healthcare system, our absolutely phenomenal doctors, nurses, therapists, pharmacists, administrators, everybody on the healthcare side, but also on the public health side, working tirelessly really for 2 years to try to stay on top of what's happening with the virus and to give Minnesotans the information and the tools that they need to protect themselves and their loved ones and their communities. I think these last 2 years have really illustrated a number of critical things, both how interdependent all the parts of our health system are on each other, that healthcare can't succeed without a strong public health system and vice versa. Acute care can't succeed without a strong long-term care system and vice versa. And just how very, very important the state-local partnership is in health and human services writ large. But within public health specifically, I think we've both seen some of the great strengths of our system, the professionalism of our people, the just unending commitment to mission and to serving Minnesotans, but also some of the gaps in the system and the cumulative effects of frankly, decades of underinvestment in the public health system at the federal level, as well as at the state level, as the funding burden for public health has shifted more and more to the local level over time, which has left us with a rather patchwork quilt of capabilities across our state. And we've seen in a pandemic such as we've been in, and it's true for many, many other public health issues as well, the need for there to be strong public health capabilities everywhere in our state so that the protections that public health provides to our citizens don't depend upon where one lives or what one's demographics are. So very, very grateful that in the revised supplemental budget, the governor has proposed a robust state investment in the public health infrastructure to really help us fill some of those gaps and to bring public health to the high level of performance statewide that all of us strive for. We know, Madam Chair and members, that there are a lot of things in the governor's budget for MDH, an unusually large number, I would say, certainly for a supplemental budget year, but in any budget year. But frankly, that represents the extraordinary opportunity that we have to make some investments in prevention with our budget surplus that we have. And some of the infrastructure pieces that would really benefit from even one-time investments. But some of the public health issues, the prevention issues that cross the whole spectrum of environmental health, chronic disease, infectious disease, regulatory protections, the number and the range of prevention proposals that you see in the budget just illustrates the wide range of issues that our communities count on public health to support them on and to lead on. So while we recognize that it's a large list from MDH, these truly do reflect public health priorities and I think reflect the fact that there is so much opportunity to do a better job on the front end on preventing problems before we have to spend precious human resources and fiscal resources trying to repair damage after it's been done. Madam Chair, I think our main goal is just to answer questions that members have on the budget, but I appreciate just a few minutes to kind of make that point that we've talked so often about in this committee over years, just the need to have a more balanced approach to prevention as well as intervention in health and human services. So thank you for the opportunity to be with you today.
Thank you so much, Commissioner. And I know that a lot of Minnesotans will join me in thanking you for your extraordinary leadership steering this ship through these very difficult times. So thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And just so members are clear and the public is clear, we are, and there is a question, but let me just say this first, that the bill we're talking about, I don't think I said this before, was House File 4398 and the A1 amendment to that bill. And even though we're not taking them up formally, we are hearing that informationally. Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner, for being here. I really appreciate hearing just the emphasis that MDH, as well as the governor, is putting on to public health and to prevention. I think the last couple of years have shown us how critical that is and how important it is to invest in our public health infrastructure. You know, one part in the budget that I was glad to see is the investment in community health workers. I just feel like they're a very important part of the public health force. So seeing an investment there is really good to see. You know, they're trusted within their community, and not just, you know, here in the metro area, but all over the state. So I'm just wondering if you could maybe talk a little bit about the importance of the community health worker to your provision, to your public health agenda. I would appreciate it.
Mr. Malcolm.
Madam Chair, Representative Freiberg, thank you for calling that out. You are absolutely right. Community health workers are a critical piece of the public health workforce, and have just risen in prominence and our understanding of the value that they bring in recent years, and especially during the pandemic. As you say, they are folks who come from the communities that they work with, whose job really is to connect with the public and with particularly underserved populations to make sure that that all populations have access to information, to prevention, and to treatment in the context of COVID, for instance, just invaluable resources to help make sure people know how to get testing and vaccination and therapeutics and the like. I think what's important about this proposal is it begins to really systematize the role of community health workers. For the most part, community health worker functions have been grant funded philanthropically or by sort of special projects. But this proposal begins to try to document the role of community health workers, to assess the value so that work can become part of the reimbursement system and part of the ongoing kind of structural support for that role within public health.
Thank you, Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, I appreciate your work.
All right, very good. So we are going to hear from a number of testifiers now, and we are gonna ask them to keep their testimony brief. And the other thing, I want to say a couple things before we start that process. First of all, I'm going to be taking notes on the testimony. So if it looks like I'm not paying attention, don't worry, I am very much paying attention. And I know that the other members are as well. And the other thing I wanted to just ask of testifiers, because we have a bill with a lot of different subjects in it, and we're going to be skipping around a bit, please do be sure to tell us. It's good if you could tell us where in the bill you are, but it's even more important if you could just make sure we understand the subject matter that you're addressing before you start to speak, so that we can understand the information you're trying to convey to us. So with that, I'm going to first call on Robert Hader. Welcome, Mr. Hader, and please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Chair Liebling and members of the committee, my name is Robert Hyder, and I am the policy director at Take Action Minnesota. We are a multiracial people's organization building power for a government and economy that work for all of us. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on House File 4398, the health supplemental. Article 1, Sections 5 through 15 expand prescription drug transparency measures. More transparency is always preferable to less, but much of the data collected through transparency laws are already available through other states, and a lack of awareness for the high cost of drugs is hardly the biggest problem that we hear from our members. It's paying for those drugs with which they struggle. Prescription drugs only work if people can afford them, and it's well established that transparency alone will not have a demonstrable impact on the costs without also increasing accountability and negotiating power at the same time. So we want to express our disappointment in the lack of any meaningful reforms to tackle the skyrocketing costs of prescription drugs in this bill. We think the administration missed the real opportunity to include a prescription drug affordability board, which would have the authority to set statewide UPLs or upper payment limits for some high-cost drugs to help patients afford the medications they need. Moving on, Article 1, Sections 1 and 2 include a growth cost commission. Take Action Minnesota strongly supports the concept of a body to review and address healthcare cost growth, However, we urge you to consider the Healthcare Affordability Board and Chair Schultz's House File 4430. That contains enforcement language and a patient protection office that are key to the success of this sort of undertaking. This bill as a whole will benefit Minnesotans, and we urge the committee to support and strengthen it. Thank you for your time.
All right, thank you, Mr. Heider. Next, I have Alana Steins. Hope I said it right. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you're with, and go ahead.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Alana Steins, and I'm the Director of Program Development at AMPACT. AMPACT is the nonprofit that delivers several of our state's AmeriCorps programs, including Minnesota Reading Corps and Minnesota Math Corps. Our programs are part of Serve Minnesota, the state's Commission on National and Community Service. And today I'm here to testify in support of the Department of Health Public Workforce Grant for our Public Health Corps program in the Governor's Supplemental Budget Bill. Minnesota Public Health Corps serves a dual purpose: to increase immediate capacity within the public health field to deliver equitable services, and to create a diverse pipeline of future public health employees. With a priority on serving communities with the highest needs, 150 AmeriCorps members will deliver critical public health services around things like community engagement and community health needs assessment, but they'll also provide increased capacity for sustained COVID-19 response and recovery at more than 60 partner locations throughout the state. Public Health Corps will benefit from a collaborative partnership with the University of Minnesota School of Public Health, which will provide expert training and individualized career planning for AmeriCorps members. We'll also partner with community organizations as a strategy to achieving health equity by recruiting a core with shared life experience and people from the communities that they're serving. Service with Public Health Corps will create pathways to post-secondary careers or education in the public health sector. After service, a minimum of 90 AmeriCorps members will pursue future engagement in the public health sector. So the grant request of $1 million in the current year and $750,000 in each of the next 2 years will increase the AmeriCorps member living allowance to the equivalent of $15 an hour, making service an equitable opportunity for more individuals. Madam Chair, committee members, please consider supporting the governor's proposal to fund the Minnesota Public Health Corps. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
All right, thank you for your testimony. Next, Anna Mueller.
Welcome. Yes. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Anna Mueller, and I'm the Clinical Director for Family Health, part of Home Care Services for Hennepin Healthcare. There are several items in the Hennepin Healthcare supports in the governor's budget proposals that are before you today, including the expansion of community health workers, long COVID research, residency training and healthcare workforce funds, investments in preventing HIV for those experiencing homelessness, and in the next bill that you'll hear later, we strongly support continuous eligibility for Medicaid for all Minnesotans. But today I'm here to talk about nurse home visiting, which is included in House File 4398, Section 86. Our nurse home visiting programs that we offer at Hennepin Healthcare are voluntary and provided by public health nurses. Each program provides support to pregnant persons and people with young children that face risks and barriers to achieving positive maternal and child health outcomes. Visits include health assessment status, home safety, and barriers to self-sufficiency. Nurses provide teaching and counseling related to pregnancy, childbirth, growth and development, and healthy lifestyle behaviors. Throughout nurse home visiting, we work to link families with community resources like WIC or early childhood family education. An average caseload for a nurse in a long-term home visiting program is 25 families. And in our universal short-term model, a nurse sees an average of 6 to 8 new families per week. I'd like to share a really quick example of a benefit of nurse home visiting. We had a 20-year-old mom that was enrolled in our nurse family partnership program. At the time of enrollment, she was 27 weeks pregnant, homeless, and struggling to stay in school. With the help and support of her nurse, her infant is now 6 months old. She has stable housing and is 5 credits away from receiving her high school diploma. During a recent visit with her nurse, the client shared that she had shared the things that she learned in her visits about introducing solid foods and safe sleep with a friend who recently had a baby. This was such a proud moment for the nurse to see the difference that her home visits were making, not just with this client, but with the community as well. There are countless examples like these taking place in our programs every day. We are grateful to the governor and MDH for proposing this increase and to Representative Liebling for carrying the bill and for the opportunity to testify here today. Thank you so very much.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Next, we have Erin Rose Prest. Welcome to the committee. Not seeing Erin Rose Prest, unless you are perhaps muted. Okay, well let's go on, and maybe if Erin comes in, we can go back. So Sarah McCumber.
Yes, welcome. Thank you. Welcome, thank you. Chair Liebling, Representative Schumacher, and committee members. I'm here to provide testimony on House File 4398. My name is Sarah McCumber. I'm president of the Minnesota Nurses Association, Minnesota Nurse Practitioners Association, and also I'm testifying on behalf of the Minnesota APRN Coalition, and I'm a nurse practitioner. APRNs, particularly NPs and midwives, are a critical part of the primary care workforce. And there are barriers to APRN expanding their presence in greater Minnesota, and we would like to work with the legislature on that issue. And as a nurse educator, I also support the loan forgiveness and support efforts to help increase clinical placements for APRNs. In Section 26, the Health Professional Education Loan Forgiveness, we support the loan forgiveness program. However, we would like to work with MDH on a technical amendment to update references to APRN throughout the statute, Minnesota Statute 144.1501, starting on page 37, line 15. The definition of APRN should be included and the definitions of the individual roles deleted. And we will be working with MDH to make sure it is a technical amendment. And then on section 27, subsection 2, we really appreciate the changes to the training grant money to be awarded to APRNs and other health professional programs to help with establishing and expanding clinical training. In section 28, there is a program that was discussed at the Primary Care Committee, which APRNs actively participated in, that was convened by the Minnesota Department of Health during 2020 and 2021. We support this program, but also would like to develop a primary care rural training grant program that supports other primary care providers, including APRNs. APRN training is not based on a residency model, and we strongly request the legislature instruct MDH to develop other rural training programs. In section 29, clinical health training, subsection 1, definitions, line 43.29, a technical suggestion for this section on line 29, insert registered practice and after nurses and delete everything from clinical through midwives. Since you have APRNs in this definition, there is no need for listing the specific roles. And also in section 29, clinical health training 44.11, we believe the reporting requirements do not work for NPs and suggest NPs be reported as number of hours instead of FTE. In NP programs, a person may do a clinical for 150 hours over an entire semester, but may have a variable schedule to complete the hours over a specific time period. Thank you for your attention.
All right, thank you for your testimony. If I could just ask, did you submit that in writing as well?
No, but I can. I will submit it to Patrick. Would that be helpful?
Oh, absolutely. When you have specific things like that, please do submit it.
I will submit it to him. Okay, thank you very
thank
much.
You. Okay, next we have Leo Cashman. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. I'm Leo Cashman, Executive Director of DAMS, Dental Amalgam Mercury Solutions. We're a nonprofit organization that has been around for 31 years, headquartered in St. Paul and serving the entire country. I want to call your attention to the Minnesota School Health Initiative, Section 51, and in particular, Subdivision 6, which regards oral health in school settings. And the particular concerns that we have here is number 2, where it provides for the use of fluoride varnish and dental sealant for the students. And number four, provide free access to fluoridated drinking water to give the students a healthy alternative to sugar sweetened beverages. Now, these might sound to be beneficial for the students, but with regard to the fluoride varnish, we have to remind people that fluoride is quite toxic. And the only argument about that is, at what levels is the toxicity a concern? In the original commercial use of fluoride, it was a rat poison and an insecticide, and it is powerful at killing germs, but it can kill a lot of living things and have biological impacts. So we are opposed to fluoride varnish and fluoride gel treatments that are sometimes used in dentistry. We think they're outdated practices because of the toxicity of fluoride, and the fluoride varnish, which is 22,500 parts per million, is ingested over time, and fluoride is a cumulative poison. With regard to fluoride in the drinking water, we now have many studies, the majority of studies on fluoride's effect, fluoridation's effect on intelligence. The vast majority of these studies find a lowering of intelligence among children with higher fluoride exposures. And four of the most important recent year studies will show that fluoride does lower intelligence. Three of those four studies were funded by the National Institutes of Health, our own federal health agency, research agency. One of the studies found a nearly tripling of fluoride of ADHD incidence in fluoridated communities in Canada compared to non-fluoridated.
Mr. ones. Cashman, I need to ask you to wrap it up.
Okay.
We're done. Thank you.
So just one final sentence. We urge modification of this, deleting the mandate for using fluoride, and ideally would be amended to prohibit the administration of fluoride and also mercury in those related clinics. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Cashman. Maren Halden, welcome to the committee.
Thank you so much, Chair Liebling and members. My name is Maren Halden, and I'm an attorney at Legal Aid, which includes the Minnesota Disability Law Center. The Minnesota Disability Law Center is our state's protection and advocacy organization that's designated by the federal government to provide free legal services to kids and adults who have disabilities across the state. And I'm really grateful for the chance to speak briefly today for our support for one provision in House Bill 4398 that is reducing health disparities for people with disabilities, Article 1, Section 47. As many of you know, people who have disabilities face significant disparities in access to healthcare and health outcomes. One of the things that we saw come out of the pandemic was actually a really strong partnership between folks at the Department of Health and disability advocates in Minnesota. People who have disabilities have faced unique challenges throughout the pandemic, and in many ways, this was reflective of the barriers that people who have disabilities face in accessing healthcare all the time. Things like finding a doctor who understands how a person's disability interacts with their healthcare needs, getting needed accommodations in healthcare settings, and more. The pandemic has also demonstrated how much we have to do as a state and as advocates to really understand the disparities in health outcomes for folks who have disabilities and finding ways to address them. And we are really grateful at DLC for the folks within MDH who demonstrated such a commitment to health equity for people with disabilities throughout the partnership during the pandemic. But it was also consistently apparent that there was so much more work to be done on this front and more resources needed. So we're really supportive of the cross-agency, cross-sector approach to reduce disability-related health disparities, to establish grants, data tracking, and technical assistance to support the department to work with partners to address these barriers. Thank you so much for the chance to speak to this briefly.
All right, thank you for your testimony. And Mary Cranky, welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Mary Krinke, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. This bill has many provisions, but given our time constraints today, I'm going to focus my comments on one provision of concern and one provision that MHA supports. In Article 1, the health policy section under Section 1, it creates a healthcare spending growth target commission. MHA has concerns about creating such a broad policy body. We should not assume that healthcare spending growth is necessarily a bad thing. Right now, healthcare providers are seeing a high demand for services, as many people previously feared coming into the hospital or clinics during the COVID surges. Unfortunately, many of these patients right now are sicker, and often because care was delayed. Healthcare spending targets may be arbitrary and may not be able to reflect current healthcare needs. Alternatively, policymakers should do more to encourage shared savings for doing population health. The Health Economics Department at MDH could be tasked with and funded to do more research and analysis of healthcare cost drivers or look at reforms in other states without setting up a bureaucratic commission. Section 28, Section 29 are Item O in the Appropriations Article 2. These are the appropriations for revitalizing the healthcare workforce, which MHA strongly supports. I would like to mention just two provisions in that Article 2. $4.5 million for a grant program for primary care rural residency training, and $12.5 million for a grant for healthcare providers to ensure the availability of clinical training for students, residents, and graduate students. We need to invest now in the education training programs to help ensure that Minnesota has the healthcare providers that we need for tomorrow. So we strongly support that provision in the governor's budget. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Krinke. So we have gotten through our list of testifiers. And so I think we could take some member questions if there are any. At this point, any questions for the testifiers? And I think that the commissioner had to leave, but there are certainly people here from the Department of Health who can answer questions if there are any from members. All right, not seeing any questions. Thank you very much, MDH folks. And so the next bill that we will discuss, and again, it's information only, is House File 4576. And this is the DHS part of the bill, so or the budget, I should say. Oh, now I'm seeing a couple of questions. Are these, okay, Representative Bierman and then Backer, if these are for the previous, these are for MDH?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, this is in regards to the testimony of Alana Symes, the Director of Programming for and Development at AMPACT, regarding the Public Health Corps.
Go ahead, Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Symes, I'm just wondering about the Public Health Corps now and whether you could tell the committee, are there any other AmeriCorps programs dealing with healthcare right now?
Yes, thank you so much for your question. This Public Health Corps AmeriCorps program is a new opportunity that has recently been kind of part of AmeriCorps, the agency at the federal level. There was a grant notice of funding opportunity, which happened back in July. And so this Minnesota Public Health Corps is underway. It's currently being planned and would begin to be implemented starting in this August of 2022. So to my knowledge, right now, this is a very unique and special AmeriCorps program that's really aimed at meeting current public health needs and growing that public health workforce.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just one more question.
Representative Bierman.
Would it be the participants would be completed with college already and then they would do 9 months or 12 months in their cycle? Is that about correct? And how many, again, would we have spots for?
Ms. Starnes.
We're currently recruiting for up to 150 full-time individuals to begin their service in part in public health course starting in August. It would be for an 11-month service term. And while we imagine that many of these individuals would be coming to us having completed a college experience, a four-year or two-year degree, we are certainly recruiting folks from all walks of life, career changers, and those who are really interested in learning about the public health workforce. And so really we're opening this opportunity to anyone who's older than 18 to apply.
Very good. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Ms. Times.
Thank you, Representative Bierman. Representative Backer.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. You know, one of the things that concern just because of inflation and everything that's going out there, the bill proposes increases in several areas. When I see that, my first question is, are they all needed? And what happens if we don't get if some of those fee increases don't happen? So that was my question. I don't know who in the department could help out with that.
And Representative Backer, could you be more specific too about what fees you're talking about? And then I don't know who's here from MDH who could address questions about fees in the budget. There's Kelly.
Well, we have the trauma system fee adjustment is one. We have the engineering plan review fees. We also have the National Suicide Prevention Lifetime Funding Fee. So, I mean, those are just some of them. And if we don't get the fees, what happens? The kind of helicopter approach.
Okay, thank you, Representative Backer. Deputy Kelly, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Those are the three fees.
And please state your name because we haven't done that yet today.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Margaret Kelly, Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Health, and thank you for your question, Representative Backer. The couple of fees that you mentioned, I'll speak to one at a time. The trauma system fee adjustment is to enable us to increase fee revenues to the department, to increase the appropriation to the department, to enable us to do a broader spectrum of work and to bring on the number of trauma centers that are applying for assistance. Provide them the advice and the guidance that they need and to carry out statutory requirements. The engineering plan review, there has been an increase in the number of facilities asking for this service. Our ability to provide that is limited by the resources that we have. And in order to increase our spending in this area, we need to increase our fee revenue as well. In terms of the 988 Suicide Prevention Lifeline, without this fee to support this activity, the Lifeline will not become effective and will have a patchwork of access to this service around the state, which defeats the purpose. So current law requires that we set fees at a level to fully recover our costs and that we maintain those fees at that level, which is what we're trying to do here.
Can you follow up, Representative Backer?
Yeah, just one follow up. On the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, funding that fee, which, you know, increases roughly 12 cents. And again, I'm not arguing that's not important because it is. But if that fee would raise roughly $10 million. So with all those new fees, if we're going to go that route, we could end the general fund appropriation of $1.3 million a year, which would also allow additional funds for that and give us some savings. Something to consider there, Assistant Commissioner Kelly. Thank you. Right.
Thank you, Representative Backer. Anything further on that, Deputy Kelly?
I'm happy to follow up with you, Representative Backer, to understand completely what you're proposing, but we are proposing a dedicated revenue stream, and there would be general fund savings associated with that we would shift some current general fund spending onto that dedicated revenue stream.
Okay, and Deputy Kelly, Could you just expound a bit on what you explained about current law requiring the department to recover costs?
Sure. I don't have the citation at my fingertips. I had it memorized a few years ago. Current law does require that agencies set a fee at a level that recovers their cost. And so at the Department of Health, we look over a five-year period of time that the fee revenue supports the spending that we do over that five-year period of time. We limit our spending when revenues start to fall short, and we look for a fee increase to maintain that balance. And we sometimes propose fee holidays when our spending is lower than we thought and revenue is too high. So that is that's how we operate our fee programs, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you very much. Okay, seeing no further questions then for MDH, I'm gonna again turn to the DHS part of the bill, and I see that Commissioner Harkstead is here, and again, we're on House File 4576 is where the language for these items can be found, and welcome to the committee, Representative Harkstead.
Thank you, Jody Harkstead, Commissioner of the Department of Human Services, Chair Liebling, and committee members. We are delighted today to present to you some of the new recommendations in the governor's revised supplemental budget. So first slide. The recommendations in the revised budget include resources to support healthcare renewals after the federal public health emergency ends, new investments in Minnesota healthcare programs, increased investments to combat the opioid crisis, and some technical changes and fixes for the department. Next slide. This is how the revised supplemental budget package in total now shakes out in terms of the various funds that flow through the department. I'll just let you look at that for a moment and we will move on. So first, some of the requirements of the department itself. The first is the continuous improvement and compliance expansion proposal. Additional resources for financial audits and contracting divisions used to hire additional auditors and contract staff to ensure compliance, auditing, and reports are carried out agency-wide. You all know about Operation Swiss Watch that we put in place after the payment errors that we discovered a couple of years ago. As you know, Chair Liebling, our Commissioner's Advisory Panel declared in December that we are now in the sixth inning of a nine-inning ballgame on having really solid process controls in the department, and these investments would help move us toward the eighth or ninth inning. The second piece here is funds to cover subpoena expenses for a pharmaceutical drug price litigation. The Attorney General's office is joining lawsuits in other states, looking at manufacturers who have potentially illegally fixed prices and allocated markets. DHS, not a party to the litigation, but it's resulted in extensive document discovery requests that DHS must comply with, and we need the resources to do that. The second category of funding that we're talking about for the department includes our service delivery transformation continuation, funding to support IT systems to transform human services delivery to create a more integrated person-centered experience, including IT work on the MN benefits application, which has gotten a strong positive response from our county partners and individuals applying for services that the department funds. And this would continue that work. Next slide. We have some additional resources requested for our licensing division. The first is simply to respond to the growth in the number of licensed services. There are a lot more providers and a lot of additional services since the last time we increased our investment in our licensing department and just the number of licensors that we have. So this would decrease the time it takes to conduct licensing visits and help us to make more visits over a two-year period of time than we are able to do today. And the last piece is emergency background study credits. As you know, we waived the requirement for fingerprint background studies during COVID. And so many people who began as new employees had to pay for an emergency background study. And now as we come out of COVID, they have to pay for a full fingerprint background study. And we're asking them to pay twice in a short period of time for two background studies. And we've discussed this many times before, but this would be a fund to credit providers for the costs incurred for those emergency background studies that they're now having to do as full studies as we come out of the pandemic. Next slide. I'm going to turn this over now to Assistant Commissioner Cynthia McDonald to tell you about our health and healthcare proposals.
Assistant Commissioner, welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner Harpstead, and good afternoon, Madam Chair and representatives. I am Cynthia McDonald, and I am the Assistant Commissioner of the Healthcare Administration and also the State Medicaid Director at DHS. Relative to healthcare, the governor's supplemental budget makes critical investments to ensure the continuation of healthcare coverage for 1.4 million Minnesotans after the end of the COVID public health emergency. It also supports the healthcare provided to members of Minnesota's American Indian communities, and it makes compliance and technical changes to align with federal law. The Department of Human Services has maintained coverage for Minnesotans who rely on medical assistance and Minnesota care through the pandemic, stopping most annual eligibility renewals, other eligibility checks, and coverage closures. This allows the state to receive additional federal funding through the federal public health emergency. Minnesota has drawn down an additional $1.9 billion in federal funding as a result of these changes, and $1.3 billion contributes to the state's general fund surplus. More importantly, it helped the state maintain high insurance coverage rates during a global pandemic. With the maintenance of coverage provisions in place, Minnesota's total public healthcare program enrollment grew by nearly a quarter of a million people to 1.44 million Minnesotans. One in four Minnesotans now receive their health coverage through medical assistance or MinnesotaCare. When the federal emergency ends, DHS must resume and complete renewals for each one of these 1.44 million Minnesotans within a 12-month period. This represents a significantly larger volume of work than has ever occurred in the state's public health care program history, and for a much larger portion of Minnesotans. This will be particularly challenging as many people are likely to have moved or changed jobs or have had other changes in life circumstances that will require a review in their renewal process. And those who gained coverage during the pandemic have never experienced the renewal process, so it will be a first time for them. Restarting the renewals will impact the health and well-being of Minnesotans, exacerbate existing workload issues, highlight longstanding fundamental state infrastructure issues, and strain the healthcare sector of Minnesota's economy. I'll go to the next slide. This unwinding of the public health emergency for eligibility will create what is being called the biggest challenge to healthcare coverage in the state since implementation of the Affordable Care Act. There are a lot of unknowns about potential coverage impacts in this redetermination effort, including how many people will become ineligible for Minnesota healthcare programs, or how many might lose coverage because perhaps paperwork is not completed in time. But we do have some preliminary estimates that I'll share here. So current estimates based on the DHS February 2022 forecast indicate that between 116,000 and 194,000 people, or 8 to 14% of enrollees, may lose their medical assistance or Minnesota care coverage because they are no longer eligible for those programs. This means that these people will need to seek coverage through MinSure or perhaps move to private health insurance through an employer. And if one of those things don't happen, they will likely become uninsured. However, even more likely, people will temporarily lose coverage due to barriers in the process. Prior to the COVID-19 pandemic, Minnesota public healthcare programs experienced significant rates of churn. If we apply the churn rates from prior to the pandemic, we can anticipate around 425,000 Minnesotans, or about 30%, may temporarily lose coverage due to paperwork getting lost or notices not reaching enrollees and other barriers that are not related to the person's actual eligibility status. But let me be clear, it's important for me to be clear that these are estimates and these numbers will change. As we all know, these are unprecedented times, which makes these predictions difficult, but we wanted to at least give you a kind of idea of the impact that we are anticipating. Disenrollment will create serious impacts to enrollees as well as other downstream effects through our healthcare and social services infrastructure as well. Closing coverage on eligible Minnesotans means, for instance, someone in a nursing home no longer has their stay covered, or someone can't pay for their PCA visits, or someone is denied a prescription drug refill, or perhaps can no longer continue their substance use disorder treatment. And as one news outlet puts it, as a quote, the Medicaid time bomb is ticking loudly. While CMS guidance is evolving, and of course we work with CMS every day conversation around this, DHS is actively planning for the end of the public health emergency and the work that needs to be done. This proposal seeks to partner with the legislature to ensure that this process occurs as efficiently and seamlessly as possible for our enrollees, our county and tribal partners, for providers, communities, and for advocates. I'll go to the next slide. In order to mitigate some of the impacts that the unwinding will have on Minnesotans, the state and processing entities that include the counties and tribes, the governor's supplemental budget includes a proposal that includes the following provisions, and I'll just walk through them briefly. One proposal is investing in project management. The success of the unwinding effort will rely on effective project management and the ability to find enrollees and clear and regular communication with enrollees, counties, tribes, navigators, communities, and stakeholders overall. We seek a vendor skilled in these areas to help us effectively strategize and provide additional dedicated staff to work on this massive effort. A second proposal is supporting navigator organizations. Navigators are one of the backbones of healthcare and critical for Minnesotans who are attempting to navigate the complex healthcare coverage universe. When the public health emergency ends, navigator organizations will play an essential role in assisting and working with enrollees within the renewal process, particularly enrollees with limited English proficiency and in BIPOC communities. Another proposal is expanding capacity for disability determinations. Based on past experience, some portion of enrollees who lose coverage after a renewal will seek eligibility for coverage under a disability status. The state medical review team, also known as SMRT process, makes these disability certifications and needs more staff for the expected significant increase in requests that will come after the public health emergency ends. Another piece is giving some enrollees more time to spend down excess assets. Some medical assistance enrollees who are subject to an asset limit have accumulated assets that they wouldn't otherwise normally have accrued during this time, and including stimulus payments, for example, from the federal government. These could result in the enrollees losing coverage. But DHS recommends providing enrollees subject to asset test a 95-day period to spend down their assets after renewal. Another provision is suspending premium collection for employed persons with disabilities, the EPD program. Minnesota has elected to take up the option to collect premiums from those determined medical assistance eligible through the EPD, the Employed Persons with Disability Program. CMS has prevented the state from kicking someone off coverage when they haven't paid premiums during the emergency. So when the PHE, the public health emergency, ends and premium collection immediately resumes, enrollees will be expected to pay premiums right away. When their case is up for renewal, which will happen on a rolling basis, their future eligibility will depend partially on whether they paid premiums between the end of the PHE and their renewal time. DHS recommends not requiring payment of these premiums until after that renewal time for them. Another provision is phasing in a return to standard policies and procedures. State law needs an update to allow continuous coverage for 12 months while renewals are completed. And also continuing to suspend periodic data matching for METS cases. METS is the eligibility system. State law requires DHS to check enrollee eligibility one time during that year outside of that usual renewal process. And this is called periodic data matching, or PDM, and it has been on hold through the federal COVID emergency period. So DHS requires the that the PDM process continues to be on hold for 12 months after the public health emergency ends, so it aligns then with CMS guidance and requirements. CMS's preliminary guidance indicates that states cannot take action to terminate an enrollee after the emergency ends before conducting a full review, the review of the renewal. And then finally, adding funding for electronic income verification. The proposal is increased funding for a vendor contract that will enable counties to meet statutory requirements to verify enrollees' wage income electronically. So there's a lot in there. It's a very critical piece of work and a very critical mound of work that is coming our way and will be impacting the state in our work. But I'm now going to turn it over to Ann Bobst, our Healthcare Administration's Legislative Director, who is going to walk through a few other provisions that are included in the bill.
All right. Ms. Bobst, welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, members. My name is Ann Bobst, and I am the Legislative Director for the Healthcare Administration at DHS. So I just want to highlight a few other proposals of the governor's supplemental budget. We do also include two provisions to support the healthcare coverage of American Indian communities. First is a proposal to support tribal providers and payments. In 2016, CMS issued guidance to states that established requirements for tribal providers around services that are provided outside of the four walls of the tribe's main tribal clinic or facility. And this is known as the four walls policy. Providers that are in compliance with those requirements may be eligible to receive the federally established daily all-inclusive rate at 100% federal financial participation for services that are rendered to tribal members. So this proposal would allow enrolled IHS facilities or select tribal health centers to elect to enroll as a tribal federally qualified health center or FQHC and direct DHS to establish an alternative payment rate, payment methodology for those tribal FQHCs. This proposal is critical for the state to be in compliance with the CMS requirements. Enforcement of those requirements has currently been suspended until 9 months after the end of the federal COVID-19 public health emergency. It also recognizes the real impact of these changes to payment methodologies that may negatively impact the ability of tribes to provide culturally appropriate services to the members of their communities. Our other proposal here is to support urban American Indians in Minnesota care or Minnesota healthcare programs. The Indian Health Board is one of only 35 urban Indian organizations in the country and the only one in Minnesota. This proposal provides grant funding to IHB in order to expand their efforts aimed at keeping eligible urban American Indians enrolled in Medicaid, improve access to quality healthcare, and increase COVID-19 vaccination rates. The Federal American Rescue Plan Act provided a 100% federal match for services provided to Medicaid enrollees who receive care through an urban Indian organization for 2 years. And although the state is currently receiving and drawing down those additional funds, there is no requirement in ARPA that states direct those additional funds to the urban Indian organization. Current state law does not authorize DHS to pass on any of these additional funds, so this proposal would allow that. Next slide, please. Lastly, there are a few supplemental budget items related to compliance with federal law and making technical changes in statute. First is the MA clinical trials proposal that was discussed Friday in this committee in relation to the healthcare policy bill. So in December of 2021, CMS updated guidance for states regarding new Medicaid state plan requirements for assuring coverage of routine patient costs associated with participation in a qualifying clinical trial. So this proposal just aligns MA coverage. This proposal will result in an unquantifiable increase in general fund spending as it adds a new covered service. But because DHS does not have knowledge about when an enrollee is participating in a clinical trial, we are unable to project potential spending increases due to this provision, and it's likely we're already paying for these services. The next proposal is also a budget neutral proposal to clarify Minnesota healthcare program enrollee error overpayments. An enrollee error overpayment occurs when an enrollee receives more medical assistance or Minnesota Care benefits than they were entitled to because of incorrect or unreported information
that does not rise to the level of fraud, theft, or abuse. State law lacks some specificity on how to assess and recover these overpayments, and this proposal stemmed from a compliance project that DHS undertook beginning in November of 2020. A review of federal and state authority in this area revealed that existing law and rule are insufficient to administer parts of these procedural aspects. And so this proposal does several things to provide clarity to our county and tribal partners. It sets forth how to assess an early error overpayment amount. It excludes children from being assessed an overpayment when they receive medical assistance or Minnesota care resulting from an error. It allows 90 days after receipt of the overpayment notice for voluntary repayment or establishing a repayment plan before the local agency or DHS attempts to revenue recapture. It prohibits overpayment recovery if the overpayment amount is less than $350, and it allows a local agency or DHS to write off the overpayment after a length of time if it's determined no longer cost-effective to pursue recovery. So the goal of this proposal is to provide guidance to our county and tribal partners so that this occurs in a more standard process throughout the state. And then finally, we have a technical fix to the newborn screening fee increase that was passed by the 2021 legislature. And that was an increase in the newborn screening fee that's charged by the Department of Health. In medical assistance, the rate for our inpatient hospital services and the fee-for-service program accounts for the cost of this test, so we did adjust our inpatient hospital rate accordingly. However, there are scenarios in which a newborn screening test may be billed in an outpatient setting because there is no inpatient hospital stay, and that's, for example, a home birth. We have identified a lack of authority to pay the MDH rate for the newborn screening when the test is billed in an outpatient setting. While this rate change was an increase to the rate paid to MDH, this change would avoid a substantial increase in charges related to the only other authority the department has to process newborn screening tests. And according to our data, there were fewer than 50 recipients who received a newborn screening service in an outpatient setting in fiscal year 2021. And then we just wanted to highlight a few items from the initial governor's budget request.
Ms. Bobst, I hate to rush you, but I'm a little bit conscious of the time here because we do have a bunch of testifiers as well. If you can move through this quickly, if this is the part that we probably already heard. Thank you.
Absolutely, Madam Chair. So just to note for members on this slide, the biggest change is for establishing 12 months of continuous MA eligibility for children under 21, the supplemental budget does have a revised effective date of January 1 of 2024 to align with the necessary systems work. That also included a proposal on increasing healthcare access and affordability, and several of the items in that proposal to improve the applicant and enrollee experience will certainly be helpful as we come out of the COVID pandemic and to undertake the unwinding process as well. And then finally, just wanted to highlight a few proposals that are out there to improve health equity, such as removing the doula supervision requirement, expanding Minnesota care coverage to undocumented children that are under age 21, and improving equitable access to the COVID-19 vaccine through community-based outreach. And I believe I am turning it over to Ms. Grom.
All right, thank you, Ms. Bobst. Ms. Grom, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Christy Grom, and I'm the Legislative Director for the Community Supports Administration at the Department of Human Services. And I just have this one final slide that I'll breeze through so you can get right to public testimony if that works for you. So this is our proposal related to the opiate settlement and the Opiate Epidemic Response Advisory Council, sometimes called ORAC. So just last week, this committee had heard about the some of the most recent national opiate settlement with Johnson & Johnson and three of the major pharmaceutical distributors. I think members have been hearing about this for a while. So thanks to our Attorney General and our staff attorneys at the state, we're expecting to receive a significant share of funding here in Minnesota from that settlement. Conversations around the settlement started back in late summer, early fall. And at that time, DHS participated in discussions and stakeholder panels. And we really spent a lot of time listening to input from the community. So we heard from public health experts and Minnesota Indian Affairs Council, other state agencies, people that were impacted by opiate use disorder. So this particular proposal on this topic was really born in large part out of those stakeholder discussions. So the primary focus of the governor's opiate proposal is to really better address the quite stark disparities that exist when it comes to outcomes related to opiate use disorders, and to really lift up the voices and experiences of Black, Indigenous, and communities of color who are disproportionately impacted. So I won't go into the initial governor's recommendations. You can see those on the slide here. But the revised budget recommendations on this topic are shown in bold typeface on the slide. So they include additional membership updates. We're adding two members, or recommending to add two members to the ORAC from the urban American Indian populations, and also requiring that 50% of the council is representative of people who've been impacted by the opiate crisis. The revised recommendations also add some base funding for overdose prevention grants, which are set to expire in fiscal year 2025. These are grants that that help to increase access to naloxone and to help prevent overdose deaths. In addition, the revised recommendations establish a new grant to support communities that have been disproportionately impacted by opiate use disorders. So these are grants that can be used for culturally specific practices and to really address some of the social determinants of health, such as housing and healthcare and education, to prevent opiate use disorders and to address the impacts of the ongoing crisis. These are grants for smaller organizations that have boards that represent communities that are disproportionately impacted. And then lastly, this isn't a new proposal, but I do want to draw members' attention to the updated language as it relates to reporting for municipalities who receive some of their settlement share directly from the settlement, and that funding that doesn't flow through the state coffers or the opiate fund, which is the special revenue fund. So in the previous version of the bill, prior to some updates, the language was not quite right. So since then, we've worked with counties and the attorney general and research scientists from MMB's Results First program to really better define the language and align it with the memorandum of understanding that's related to the settlement agreement. So we're hopeful that the updated language strikes the right balance of really achieving accountability, administrative ease, and most importantly, the ability to get a glimpse into some of the promising practices that are happening at the local level. And so that is the overview for this particular proposal. Thank you so much for the opportunity to present our package today. We're happy to answer questions and look forward to continued discussions. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Grom and team. So next, we will move to Nate Clark, who is with NMSHRE. Mr. Clark.
Good afternoon, Chair Liebling and members of the committee. My name is Nate Clark, and I am the CEO of NMSHRE. Thanks again for having us back before the committee today to provide a brief overview of the governor's proposal for NMSHRE IT modernization. I'll be brief, since I know the committee has already heard much of this information, and it goes without saying that I'm happy to answer any questions you might have now, or if you have additional time to consider the proposal. As you know, NMSHRE is a one-stop shop for private health insurance and public programs. Minnesotans looking to access a private plan on the individual market or Minnesota Care or medical assistance can visit NMSHRE.org to submit an application that determines eligibility for those coverage options. The application and eligibility technology platform used by NMSHRE was launched in 2013 and is shared by partners at the Department of Human Services and the counties. The platform is referred to as the Minnesota Eligibility Technology System, or METS, and since the launch in 2013, NMSHRE has worked with our agency partners to upgrade the platform and improve service delivery for Minnesotans. In addition to shared maintenance and upkeep of the METS platform, NMSHRE has also made several strategic investments that improve the consumer experience for Minnesotans who apply for qualified health plans. However, limitations in the underlying application and customer management technology continue to hamper our efforts to further improve service delivery and to reach more uninsured and underinsured Minnesotans. NMSHRE has responded to these limitations with manual work processes and higher staffing levels, and through frequent costly IT updates to the IT platform. These improvements are incremental, however, and don't address the constraints that prevent us from offering Minnesotans the service experience they want and need. This brings me to the governor's recommendation for NMSHRE in this year's supplemental budget. The governor is recommending upgrading and replacing the core technology that supports NMSHRE to improve the experience for Minnesotans who use the technology to apply, shop for, enroll, and maintain their enrollment in a qualified health plan through NMSHRE. The proposal also improves the systems and tools caseworkers use to manage enrollee information. Upgrading the legacy IT platform is necessary to provide in a streamlined, simple, and more efficient application enrollment experience and that is easy to use and that removes barriers that make it difficult for Minnesotans to access and maintain health insurance coverage. As a reminder to the committee, I'll provide a brief rundown of the features and benefits of the upgrade. The upgrade preserves the no-wrong-door...
Mr. Clark, really briefly, please.
Absolutely.
We don't need the detail.
Okay, great. I'll just say you can see on this screen a quick update of the key features of this of the upgrade that is being recommended in the proposal. And I will wrap by simply with looking at the next slide, which provides a quick overview of the fiscal impact. Costs include minute costs to decommission QHP programs from the legacy system, licensing of replacement application eligibility assister and other technology from an outside vendor, and then 1 year of maintenance and operations costs as we transition. Total cost is $18.8 million over 3 years. That's all the information that I've prepared for the committee today. Just like to close again by saying again how grateful we are to be here, sharing the details of the proposal, and we are happy to answer any questions that the committee may have. Thank you, Chair Liebling.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Clark. And sorry to hurry you along, but we do want to make sure we can hear from our testifiers as well. So thank you. Okay. First person to testify then, or I should say the next one, is Megan Helena. Welcome to the committee.
Hi. Thank you, Chair Liebling and members of the committee. I'm here to talk about navigator organizations and the federal public health emergency. My name is Megan Helena, and I'm a program director at Generations Healthcare Initiatives in Duluth. And like I said, I'm here to talk about the impact of the federal public health emergency on navigator organizations, the role that navigator organizations play in healthcare coverage, and the anticipated impact on people's coverage as the public health emergency is lifted. Generations is the lead agency for a local coalition in Duluth with three partners that are navigator organizations, and I am also representing a statewide coalition of navigator organizations comprised of 35 partners from across the state. One thing we all have in common is that we've been impacted by the continuous coverage requirement for public health care programs that is in place due to the federal public health emergency. This means that people who are covered by medical assistance in Minnesota Care have not had adverse changes applied or had renewals since the start of the pandemic. This is a good public health measure as it has meant that people are insured. However, it has impacted navigator organization budgets negatively. In Duluth, the navigators in my group primarily assist people who have public program coverage. It's about 80 to 90% of our work. Much of that work, like helping with renewals, comes with one-time payments. These one-time payments are an important part of navigator organization budgets, and having them reduced during the pandemic has negatively impacted navigator capacity. Now, as we prepare for an end to the public health emergency and a return of renewals and people falling off coverage and needing to re-enroll, it is important that navigators are in place to provide free help to anyone who needs it. Navigators will do the important work of breaking down barriers for people who struggle with limited English proficiency, with technology, transportation, paperwork, and simply managing a confusing system. Please keep in mind that navigators will be critical support for people as the public health emergency ends and renewals for healthcare coverage resume. Thank you for listening.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. Perla Ramos Rodriguez Unidos, welcome.
Yes, that's me. Hello, chair members of the committee. That's me, Perla Ramos. My name is Perla Ramos. I am an organizer with Unidos Minnesota in Fe and Justicia in St. Cloud, where we offer the monthly health clinics, care clinics for the community. And I am here in support of the Article 2, Section 9 in the House File 4576 to allow undocumented immigrants under 19 in Minnesota Care. You have a letter with more information. I want to share a story, Reyna's story about her family from Honduras. and they live in Wilmar. She couldn't not be here, but asked me to share her story, she says. My daughter is 11 years old. She was a vibrant child who loved and exceeded in school until last year when she got COVID-19. My husband works to support us, but we have no health insurance, so we try to take care of health needs within our home. But we had to take care. We had to take her to the emergency room in Wilmar in the hospital, and then taken into the Minneapolis hospital where she was remained in coma for a month. Twice she has lost hair and is very afraid. Her grades have fallen, and she has a difficult time recalling things she knew before. This has taken a toll on her mental health. We can afford to continue the follow-up appointments needed to restore her being. We are unable to pay the high hospital bills we already have. We continue to receive calls and bills from them, which are impossible for us to survive. We are responsible people, but without insurance, we have been devastated. This bill will provide the security to know that when sickness invades your home, you can seek the necessary help. Thank you, and please support this bill, and please consider expanding above the age of 19 for the parents and essential workers and others who are also a part of this state. Thank you.
All right, thank you for your testimony. Robert Hyder, welcome back.
Hello, Madam Chair. Thanks again for having me. My name is Robert Hyder, and I am the Policy Director at Take Action Minnesota. First, we want to highlight Article 2, Section 9, which would make undocumented Minnesotans under the age of 19 eligible for Minnesota care. Undocumented immigrants are neighbors, families, co-workers, essential workers, caretakers, and community members, and they need health care like all of us. We strongly support this important step toward health equity and inclusion. Next, I want to highlight Article 3, the Minnesota Care Buy-in to expand the affordable and high quality Minnesota Care Program. This provision would allow Minnesotans who are currently over income for Minnesota Care to buy into this program, which would reduce underinsurance and expand access to quality health care. And this article also maintains affordable premiums for current Minnesota Care enrollees. We also strongly support the measures to upgrade and replace the IT technology that are a platform for the state healthcare exchange. These upgrades will help consumers, navigators, and brokers alike. The funding is found in the Appropriations Article, Section 5, Article 3. Likewise, the improvements to the eligibility and enrollment systems for MA and Minnesota Care found in Article 5, Section 2, Subdivision 4, for strengthening equity and access. Finally, as we move this bill forward, please consider including several important provisions of the Minnesota Care buy-in found in House File 11, namely the small business buy-in, inclusion of undocumented immigrant adults, and the temporary subsidies and small business tax credits that help Minnesotans during the transition to a buy-in. Thank you for your time and this opportunity to speak with you today.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Hyder. Maren Holden.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Maren Holden, and I'm an attorney at Legal Aid, which includes the Disability Law Center. Thank you for having me back. As you know, Legal Aid represents low-income Minnesotans, and for our clients, access to healthcare is a really key part of our work on behalf of our clients. When they don't have healthcare, their chronic conditions get worse, they lose access to needed medications, and they often end up needing far more intensive and expensive care later on. House File 45676 includes several provisions that would help more of our clients overcome barriers to healthcare coverage. The first I'll highlight is continuous Medicaid eligibility for children. That's Article 2, Section 3. One of the things that we've gotten to see from the pandemic is what continuous coverage for Medicaid would look like. And what we saw, and you've heard this before, is that re-enrollments dropped, suggesting that many people who are and continue to be eligible get dropped because of paperwork each month. I think we just heard an estimate from Ms. McDonald that DHS anticipates that something like 425,000 people could lose Medicaid because of paperwork after the public health emergency ends, even though they remain eligible. And this is something that we're obviously very concerned about. which is why we really appreciate the provision for 12-month continuous coverage because it's for children, because it's so important for health outcomes, encourages kids to get their well child appointments, provides coverage for ongoing conditions, and establishes consistency for families. We do strongly support this for children, but we also support it for adults, and we would encourage the committee to consider take an approach that would expand this 12-month continuous eligibility to adults too. We support other provisions in this bill that would ensure better access to needed health care, including the Minnesota Care buy-in. Many of our clients have seasonal or other jobs that result in fluctuating income, and this would allow continued access to needed health care. Minnesota Care coverage for undocumented youth. All kids need to get the health care that they need. And maintaining premiums for the current Minnesota Care program at levels outlined in the ARPA, which is important to keep health care coverage affordable. We also are very we're tracking what will happen when the public health emergency ends and how our state is preparing for off-ramping. And so we are grateful for the inclusion of several provisions regarding that you heard about from Ms. McDonald, including the short-term asset limit disregard, preserving healthcare coverage as needed to comply with federal guidance until the first renewal, lining up MAEPD premiums with the timing of the person's first renewal, more funding for disability assessors. Even before the pandemic, many of our clients who have disabilities found the wait time for getting the SMRTed quite long. And with the disability impacts of long COVID, this will be even more pressing as we roll off from the public health emergency. And finally, the navigators are more important than ever following this off-ramp. So thank you so much for the opportunity to share Legal Aid's views.
Thank you, Ms. Holden. And finally, Mary Krenke. Ms. Krenke, there she is.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mary Krenke, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. I'm going to focus my comments on two provisions that MHA supports and one provision of concern. Article 2, the healthcare, Section 3, and this has been mentioned, but MHA supports having a 1 year of medical assistance coverage for children under the age of 21 without having to requalify or re-enroll in the program during the course of this year. Once qualified and enrolled, it should be continuous coverage for 1 year. This will reduce churn, reduce paperwork, and will produce better outcomes for our children. The other one I want to mention that we support is in Article 5, the appropriations section, and there hasn't been much talk about this. The MHA supports the many mental health grants that are included in the governor's budget. I want to mention two provisions that MHA strongly supports. The $20 million for workforce incentive grant programs for mental health public program providers for incentive benefits for both current and new workers. It's really important with all the workforce shortages that we really try to do whatever we can to keep our mental health professionals working in the field. And $10 million for grants to expand inpatient psychiatric and the psychiatric residential treatment facilities for children's mental health services. We need to have more mental health programs that have a housing component. This is part of the reason we have backups in the emergency room, is just because there's not enough services for mental health that have a housing component. And I do want to mention that the Hospital Association has had a historic position against the Minnesota Care buy-in, particularly if it doesn't have an upper income threshold. We need to have an upper income threshold, making sure that the program is primarily for low income individuals. If enrollment is allowed to be broader than that, we don't believe the current payment rates would allow for a sustainable current healthcare system. One of the options might be to look at, should the Minnesota Care eligibility income be raised, potentially helping those who are purchasing on the exchange or have employer-sponsored health care to deal with their deductibles. Thank you, Madam Chair, and look forward to working with members as this bill moves through the process.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Krenke, and thank you to all of the testifiers. Members, we do need to finish in about 2 minutes here, so are there any pressing questions from members? All right, I am not seeing any. So I know there's going to be a lot more discussion on all of the topics in these bills. Thank you again to the presenters and to the testifiers. And with that, we stand adjourned.